Yes, I think there is a spark that actually started in Tunisia. And after years and years and decades of the citizens of the Middle East, North Africa region being pretty much voiceless, suddenly that spark in Tunisia and that first uprising in Tunisia, which was described as the Jasmine Revolution, I think that began to have some sort of a domino effect and unleashed this freedom-seeking spirit within the Arab world and the North African world that were pretty much not evident for decades. And what we are seeing these days from Tunisia to Egypt to Bahrain, Libya, Yemen, and many other countries, I think is a consequence of that initial spark.
It is very much a young people's uprising, isn't it? They're the movers and shakers behind it. Because if we look at the average age of the population in many of the affected countries, a high percentage of them are under 30, aren't they? And then there's also quite a high literacy rate amongst these people.
Yes, that is true. I mean, what I've described the people in the streets, in the different squares and roundabouts, as being the Twitter and Facebook generations that have suddenly decided to take matters into their own hands. And yes, those are people who do not particularly belong to any political ideology, nor to any religious background, but are just men and women who've had enough of being second and third class citizens in their own countries and now are seeking that sense of dignity, respect, and freedom that I think any human being should expect and celebrate.
Do you believe that many of the, as you said, long-standing leaders of these regimes in this area are likely to be sleeping uneasily at the moment, fearing for their continuing hold on power? Do you see some that are particularly vulnerable?
Of course. I think pretty much everybody feels vulnerable in this region. I mean, when it started initially in Tunisia, the question was whether this was a one isolated incident in a country that is lovely to visit as a tourist, but is not really at the heart of the region. However, once that revolution moved on to Egypt, the largest and most important Arab country in North Africa, I think that's when people started realizing that this is beginning to gain a momentum that could pretty much prove to be unstoppable. And as we have seen, other countries, the bloodbaths in Libya have been truly horrendous. Even in other countries such as Morocco have also begun to show this sense of unrest. So in a sense, I don't think any leader in the Middle East or North Africa can sleep soundly knowing fully well that something could happen in his country. Hence why now there is this zeal for reforms in many of those countries. Now those reforms, in my opinion, have been long overdue, but whether those reforms at this late stage might ward off any drastic changes in other countries, again, is something that we'll have to wait and see, because nobody knows where the wave will hit next.
Now, you talk about nobody knowing, of course, where the wave will hit next. But do you think it could spread beyond the Middle East and North Africa region? Or do you think there's certain factors there that are making this particularly vulnerable, or shall we say, likely to have these popular uprisings?
I think in a sense, Susie, what I have often asked myself over many years is that when East Europe freed itself from the shackles of communism, when I saw movements happening in terms of social development and social justice in some African countries and also in Latin American countries, the question that I often used to ask myself, why doesn't this happen in the Middle East and North Africa? What is it about the Arab world and the Arab peoples? Is there something genetically preventing them from rising up and freeing themselves from what pretty much was a state of subjugation in many of those countries. And I could never actually get an answer to that. Was it the fear of repression? The authorities were so firmly in control of the country that people were afraid to go out in the streets? Was it a basic fatalism that is part of the culture of this vast region? I was never too sure of it, but now I've come to realize that, as we were talking just a minute ago, the initial spark which created this momentum from Tunisia onward is basically a sense of self-determination. There are many ways one could describe this, but perhaps the best way is to say that this is a sense of popular self-determination, where people power has finally come of age, and where the people of the region are basically reclaiming what is a very rich heritage that they've had in history and saying that enough is enough. And I also believe that part of the reason why it's happening now, when I refer to the Twitter and Facebook generations, is because we have become a smaller global village. We are now so much linked that what happens in one remote corner of the world is immediately transmitted to other parts of the world. So when the citizens of this region have seen what democracy means in the United States, in Europe, in other parts of the world, then inevitably this is something I believe that has fed into their own zeal to come out and free themselves.
And how do Christians in the Mideast region fit into this equation? We know all about Christians emigrating from many areas in the Middle East. And we saw how in Egypt, you know, there were Christians out there demonstrating with the other young people in Cairo's Tahrir Square during the Egyptian uprising. Do you think they stand to gain or lose? Because look what happened in Iraq, when the Christians were actually left relatively alone and unscathed during the dictatorial regime of Saddam Hussein. And now there's greater democracy, but all kinds of sectarian bloodletting has been unleashed.
I couldn't agree with you more, Susie. I mean, this is a particular worry for me and also for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. We discuss this matter fairly frequently, and again, it's very difficult to predict which way it's going to go. It also depends on what form of state building will take place once the dust has settled down. But you're absolutely right. The plight of the Iraqi Christians is horrendous. The problems that the Coptic Christians, be they the Coptic Orthodox or the Coptic Catholic churches, have faced is equally bad over decades. So it is something that one needs to keep an eye on and to make sure that we speak out and we stress that citizenship rights does not discriminate on the basis of religion. And this is something that applies as much to Egypt as it does to Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and all the other countries of this vast region.
And finally, when we contemplate all this upheaval going on, is there a lesson to be learnt from this by the West, who, of course, for decades has supported somewhat autocratic regimes in the region, like, say, that in Egypt?
I think we in the West, Susie, have had a rude awakening, and a rude awakening in the sense that for many, many years we have thought that if we support dictators and autocracies, if we basically go for security and stability, which in a sense meant keeping those rulers on their thrones or on their chairs and making sure that Islamism or political Islam does not become a factor we in the West need to deal with, we thought that that would provide us with the security and the interest we in the West need in order to have a decent life. However, what has happened now, I think, has completely shaken up that vision. And I believe that many, many European leaders and also increasingly the U.S. administration are coming to realize that they are actually in the wrong, and that what needs to be done now is to renegotiate the way we look at the Middle East, North Africa region. And of course, keeping well in mind for me as a practicing Christian that the large Christian communities which are local and indigenous to the region also retain a voice so that their rights are not trodden over as well.
Harry Hagopian, a consultant on Mideast affairs for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales.